House Environment and Energy, May 10th, 1989, 1:30 p.m., Hearing Room E.
Now let me indicate to you how, in the sequence, we want to take these issues. We will take Senate Bill 1060 and then Senate Bill 576 first, and then proceed from the top of the agenda, work session on Senate Bill, House Bill 3483, and then the hearings on 2854, 3493, and Senate Bill 882. I will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 1060 and ask Phil Barrett and Tom Novak, Mike Graney to come on up, and then Art Mansell. All right. All right, why don't you come up, and as soon as we get a spot here for you, we'll add you to it. Welcome, and why don't you go ahead and give us some background of the bill. It's Senate Bill 1060. It's a public hearing and possible work session. We're in public here at the moment. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tom Novak with the Solar Energy Association. Appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 1060 today. 1060 was introduced at the request of the Solar Energy Association and comes to you after passing the Senate on a vote of 27-1. A lot of work went on the other side making sure that all parties to the bill were in agreement, and there was a final hearing, no testimony in opposition to it. Essentially what Senate Bill 1060 does is require that the state lead our state in energy conservation when it comes to building new buildings by putting all cost-effective energy conservation measures into new state buildings. It makes sense as a long-term investment, and it also makes sense as public policy when we are trying to get the commercial and private sector to do the same. I'd like to have Phil Barrett, the director of the Solar Energy Association, give just a quick overview of the operation of the bill and how it'll work.
Thank you. As Tom mentioned, the bill was amended extensively in Senate committee. The amendments, the most important thing about them, I think, was the fact that they did not change the energy efficiency standard that appeared in the bill as it was originally requested by us. The standard still is the same. It's that all new buildings will incorporate all cost-effective energy conservation measures. The main changes were a shift in responsibility for making sure that the state buildings did in fact incorporate all of the cost-effective measures. The way the bill had originally been drafted, the Department of Energy had a major role in that process. That was changed so that the authorized state agency responsible for the building is also responsible for making sure that the standards of the bill are met. The other major area of amendment was in establishing a smooth transition mechanism. What we're doing with this is breaking into a process. The planning and design of a building is an extended process over many months, and we've got to break in there someplace. And so the other pieces of the amendments related to that. In terms of the key parts of the bill, I think Section 2, Subsection 3, the definition of cost effectiveness is an important thing to point out. That definition is verbatim out of Oregon's state energy policy in 469.020, Subsection 3. The way that this will work is that every utility in the state will have a slightly different level of cost effectiveness that's going to be feasible in their service territory depending on their rates and the kinds of resources that they're looking at for acquisition in the long term. So that this is all taken care of in the definition of cost effective there and will be reflected in the process as it evolves. The second major change is in Section 2, Subsection 7, where there's changing the definition of major facility from 25,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet. The justification for that can be found on a chart that's attached to my testimony on the last page. It's a little bit difficult to understand, but the net effect of it is that for most of the buildings that the state will be building, for anything over about 10,000 square feet, standard practice in the region now indicates that that building should be modeled on a computer. Its energy performance should be input into a computer to try to predict what kinds of energy conservation measures make sense. For anything under 10,000 square feet, we use what we call a prescriptive path, which means it's a small enough building that we can just list out a set of measures that any, say, office building should incorporate in terms of the kinds of windows and the type of air conditioning system and the types of lights to be installed, and those kinds of things can be listed out, and the designer can refer to that list as they're designing. When you get to something bigger, over 10,000 square feet is typically a building over $1 million. It's worth the time and effort to model that building to decide what indeed is the best combination of energy efficiency measures to incorporate in the building. Section 3, subsection 1 is the key to the heart of the bill, where it requires all new state buildings to incorporate all cost-effective measures. Section 2, subsection 3, subsection 2 is the portion of the bill that lays out the process by which the authorized state agency and the Department of Energy will cooperate and in the design of the facility. This process in itself will actually be simplified significantly because some of the local utilities that are serving the state facilities around the state are now adopting conservation programs of their own that are intended to bring all of the buildings in their service territories up to the level of efficiency that we have in mind in this bill. So if a state building can hook up with its local utility to get involved in a program like that, that'll just make the process a whole lot easier for the Department of Energy, and they should, in most cases where that happens, sign off on the utilities program and say that that the building, if it meets those standards, will also meet the standards that are laid out in this bill. One important factor that's laid out in subsection 2 there is the fact that the agency and the Department of Energy will agree on what constitutes a list of reasonable measures for analysis. There, one thing that's important to remember with energy efficiency is that the goal of energy efficiency is not to try to dictate how a building is used. What it says is, however that building needs to be used, we should do it as efficiently as possible. So for example, in a prison, we may have federal restrictions that say you've got to have this level of lighting and this level of ventilation, and there are probably a lot of restrictions on that. What we want to do is make sure that that's done as efficiently as possible. Another issue there is indoor air quality. We don't want to incorporate any kinds of energy efficiency measures in a building that are going to compromise indoor air quality. There's no indication here, no question that we're trading health effects against energy savings. That just is not an option.
Now, Phil, let me ask you, is there any, I was thinking about that as I was listening to your testimony, is there any need to put in this bill a statement that says that something to the effect that in the pursuit of conservation that appropriate ventilation must also be a consideration?
My recommendation would be that it not be included. Ventilation is a health question, it's not an energy question. The appropriate place to deal with ventilation is in health-related legislation, and Michael, you might talk about, there is indoor air quality legislation that's now active before the legislature.
But isn't that part of the problem, that we tend to separate these things out and never relate them?
They are being related. I sort of take umbrage at the suggestion that we in the energy conservation community are not very concerned about indoor air quality.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that, but you're saying this was energy and the other was a health problem. Where do you relate them in statute?
Typically, the building code is the appropriate place to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people, and that's where the health issues need to be addressed. I'm not familiar enough with the process to know how well that is working in Oregon right now. Michael may have a better idea.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. In response to the specific question on indoor air quality, I think the statute is flexible enough. It uses the term a number of times, reasonable energy conservation measures. And it was intended to cover a number of variables. Indoor air quality is one. Another is the cost and the time it takes to build the building. We don't want the energy conservation measures to be an obstruction to completing buildings that may have, because of other considerations, a short, very urgent time schedule, some of the prisons, for example. And I think the bill gives us the flexibility to take those things into account. At the same time, if there's other legislation, such as the indoor air quality bill, that has specific standards that are health-driven, ventilation standards or other standards that would be appropriate that are adopted, I think they would be, we would incorporate those in our design review as part of the direction from this bill. So I think we can achieve your goals without being necessarily being too specific here.
Representative Keeson, you had a comment or question?
I was just going to ask Mike on page 2, line 2, when we get into the definition of a cost-effective energy conservation measure, that there is a reference on line 2 to environmental impacts. I'm wondering if that phrase would also encompass some notion of environmental impact, the health, the effect on the indoor environment. They're reading it too broadly, or think that might fall into that as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiesling, I think it can. I think as our understanding of energy issues has expanded and the health consequences of some of the house tightening things has occurred, I would certainly interpret it that way.
I wonder if we couldn't have a section or added phrase that would simply say environmental impact, comma, including appropriate ventilation.
Chairman, I would recommend something a little bit broader than that.
Okay.
Something that ties in the relative risk of different considerations. I've talked to the members of the Solar Energy Association about this, and my first question, I'd like to ask them here publicly about the statement environmental impact. How is a cost factor determined for environmental impact? And are we considering the whole realm of environmental impact, both indoor, quality of life? Just exactly what does that term mean, and where is it defined?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wehage, we really are in the infancy in a lot of ways on understanding ways to incorporate environmental impacts in our decisions about energy resource development. You probably are aware that the Oregon Public Utility Commission, for example, just adopted a least cost planning order that has national significance in the way that it addresses environmental costs. And it says that the utilities are expected to make a good faith effort to try to identify and quantify the environmental costs associated with all of their resources, both generating resources and conservation resources. So what we're trying to do now is find some way to compare a range of resources for their environmental effects. We don't have a very good handle on that. I think Oregon may well be one of the leaders in the nation in developing that kind of work, but it's going to be a few years before we have a very good handle on it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
The wording that I was going to suggest would tie in the relative health risk aspects into that same statement, Statement E, environmental impact, including relative health risk. And I think that it can work both ways. If you have a polluting source of energy that has a negative health impact, and yet we've seen, based on testimony here, that there can be a negative health impact also from conservation efforts to seal up buildings and make them more energy efficient. And so I'd like to see that type of wording added at this point. I had a few other concerns, though, if I may. I was going to suggest that we also add a phrase at this point to address operating and maintenance costs of the energy source or energy system that's being considered in the cost analysis. I don't see anything here under subsection 3 which would suggest that we include operating and maintenance costs. I think that's certainly appropriate because that's a key factor. Maybe I'll just go ahead and let this gentleman identify.
Mr. Chairman, Art Mansell, Department of Higher Education. Specifically, what you're questioning is one of the reasons that I brought up the idea of using reasonable. If you have something reasonable, then you do take care of those concerns. I'd like to speak to one other thing. And
let me ask you, where would you be putting the word reasonable?
It's in a number of places.
Already in the statute, I mean in the bill.
Yes. Regarding indoor air quality, I just happened to bring along a little bit of reading so I could take up the time between an earlier hearing. And one of the things was a report from BPA where they were studying the indoor air quality in 38 buildings in the Northwest. There's that factor. The information in that is just becoming available. According to what Phil said, we're just finding out what some of the criteria is. The other thing is the American Association of Heating, Ventilating, Refrigeration Engineers are revising their ventilation standards, and they're looking at all these studies. So I think we are just a little ahead of tying it down very tightly.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Agnes.
Well, I don't want to walk past the point that Representative Wheat has just raised. I think it needs further emphasis. That is, in looking at capital expenditures and determining shape that they will take, it is one of the most important things that you do is look long-term at the operating and maintenance costs. Now, there's an inference in here of some of that, where in subsection 3 of section 2, it talks to cost escalations and future availability of fuels. That's part of the operating cost, but not all of it. There are some operating costs in here, but I can consider that there will be some operating costs that are not in here. There are some things you might put in that require operators. Others may be automatic and require a minimum of maintenance or a lot of maintenance. You know, those are all very important aspects of any financial calculation. And I really wonder with Representative Wehase whether the bill should be amended to include that very specifically.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Agruns. Part of our energy analysis that we would do, and this is true both for existing buildings and for design of new buildings, tries to quantify those things and take that into account. So we look at the operating costs, the operating energy costs, the operating costs of it's an energy system, take that into account. I guess I view our obligation under this bill to address those things that you pointed out. And if the committee wanted to make that more specific, that would be fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm glancing down at your energy consumption analysis, and I think that's in the next portion there, sub 5, renumbered sub 5. I don't find anything specifically that deals with that concern in there. We're dancing around it, but a simple notation of operating and maintenance costs, it seems to me, is absolutely fundamental to any analysis that you do, and it ought to be so stated.
Go ahead, Tom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Agruns, in our view, that's not a large problem, but I think if you look at the definition in sub 3 of cost effective, it says that an energy resource facility or conservation measure during its life cycle, and our interpretation is that when you're looking at the life cycle of a resource, you're looking at the cost of operating it, maintenance, and the other factors involved. So
you wouldn't have any objection to specifically stating operating and maintenance costs then, would you?
I might.
Go ahead.
Representative Agron, our concern at this point is more a question of timing than I'm fully in accord with your concerns.
Your concern also is in passing out a bill, isn't it?
Yes. What we've got here in terms of timing, and I was just about ready to get to this in my testimony when I was working on it, and Section 3, subsection 4, it lays out some language for the transition that we'll use. What it says, the first sentence in that says that any building that is too far along in the process will not be subject to the provisions of this bill. It also says that any building for which the 1989 legislature does not appropriate funds for the incremental costs of achieving the energy efficiency that we're talking about in this legislation also will not be required to comply with the provisions of the bill. Our goal is to get this adopted by the legislature before the Capital Construction Subcommittee of Ways and Means starts meeting. My feeling is that the way the bill is presently written, it addresses your concerns. And the way that we have in this region over the last 10 years really addressed energy efficiency, operation and maintenance is play a prominent role in the analysis that we do. It's standard practice in the region to take account of that. The Department of Energy has been adopting that as standard practice for many years. I think that your concerns are addressed adequately by the bill, but that's obviously a question that the committee will have to address. Our goal is to move this bill along as fast as we can. If it does go back for an amendment, it could be several weeks before we finally get concurrence from the Senate, and by that time, who knows where Ways and Means Capital...
Well, let me say that if what we add to it is what I think my colleagues are suggesting, appropriate and reasonable amendments, and there's no reason the Senate shouldn't concur, is there?
No.
And it wouldn't take any time at all.
Being a reasonable body, I don't think.
Mr. Chairman. One question I wanted to pose to Mike from the Department of Energy, and that's on page 3 on subsection C, 3C, regarding the fee that DOE would charge for doing this energy analysis, 0.2% of the capital construction. Is it understood that that cost would be factored into the overall cost analysis? In other words, does that cost in and of itself become part of the overall cost analysis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weehage, yes. I think also, and we put in a number there as a cap, I think in some cases there'd be very little cost. One of the things that was talked about earlier, some of the utilities, EWEB, for example, is participating in a BPA program that the analysis that's talked about here is what they're offering. And if the utilities can undertake the service for the state buildings, we'd be delighted and we would encourage that. And I think we have the flexibility by rule to certify their program. And I view this as flexible enough to let us do the design work up front with the agency that's building the building and minimize our role as much as possible.
You have no objection into adding a statement at this point then that says that cost or that fee would be included in the cost analysis required under ORS 276915 subsection 2?
No, not at all.
Okay. You just said that you didn't think it would be very expensive, and I would agree with you if it were just a straightforward energy balance analysis. That there's software packages these days that are extremely readily available. They're extremely easy to use, but they don't take into account environmental impact. And I'm curious, just, you know, what does that phrase mean to you in doing some sort of energy analysis?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Weehage, the reason I don't view this as significant in terms of the department's workload, the way we have tried to construct this with the Senate amendments that were incorporated, largely the concerns that Art Mansell brought up to us was to try to do as much as we could through the contractor who would normally be designing the building for higher education. And simply as one of their additional requirements will be energy considerations that we and higher ed or general services, whoever the state agency is, would agree to in advance. And then we would review those energy conclusions and make our recommendations back to that state agency again. So our role is, I think, pretty limited.
What you're saying then is that in the future we're going to see it written into the contract for renovations and for new construction that the architect, engineer, whoever has responsibility for design would do an energy analysis on the building, and that would be reviewed by DOE.
Right.
Okay, I really, frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a very good bill. I think with a couple of minor changes here, I would be very happy to support it.
I think it's a good bill, too, but I think this, a couple of the suggestions do have some merit. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to see if we pursue the suggestions, and I agree with Representative Wehead that if the place to do it, and maybe get these gentlemen's reaction to it, is under the definition of cost-effective in 3, we would just, under E, we would have environmental impact, and then maybe language such as including potential risk to indoor air quality, and then do a sub-F, which would say cost of operation and maintenance, and address both those issues in that particular part of the statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiesling, my concern in amending subsection 3 there, the definition of cost effective, is that that definition is verbatim out of the state's energy policy in 469020. I would like, if at all possible, to preserve that identity. And to adopt any other additional changes in the way we interpret the definition of cost effectiveness someplace else in the statute, I'm perfectly willing to try to find ways to do that. The definition of cost effectiveness in 469020 is obviously the cornerstone of the state energy policy, and I'm very uncomfortable at this point changing it because of potential implications, not necessarily potential implications for changes, major changes in state policy being done through the back door, basically.
Can I try to avoid that. Can I try something else?
let me ask you, why is this through the back door? This is a statute that would indicate clearly what you have to take into account, and it gives directions to the Department of Energy. I don't understand the back door. Phil, are you saying that anytime we deal with a piece of legislation that might change the definition, we're doing it through the back door? Let me first of all say, I understand why you want this out quickly and you don't want it changed, but it seems to me what the committee is doing is trying to figure out ways to improve it with some issues that they have some concern about. Go ahead, Representative Peasley.
Well, the other alternative would be to reference in Section 3 under Sub 2, where we have identifying all reasonable cost-effective measures, to just put language that in determining the reasonableness of measures, shall consider potential risk to indoor air quality and cost of operation and maintenance.
I'd be much more comfortable with that.
That put it under the reasonable sections.
I think the impact would be the same.
I think it would, too. I'm not sure I quite share the thing that you have to keep definitions that are in rule always in statute, but if we can accomplish the same thing that meet the concern of Representative Wehead, Representative Agrons, and do it in this way, maybe that's the way that
okay. We're not in a work session, but go ahead, and we'll come back to this in a minute. Representative Parkinson.
Yeah, I have a question to Mr. Barrett. We've kind of skirted around the issue, but why is time of the essence, and what particular buildings and construction? What specific buildings or construction program are we talking about? Time is of the essence.
At this point, there are several. Representative Parkinson, we haven't developed any particular list of buildings that we are, you know, going to work on. Probably what we'll do is identify a priority list of buildings from the governor's budget that look like they're going to, you know, have legs and might potentially be funded, and try to work with Ways and Means on those to fund the incremental costs for the energy efficiency measures. Our focus will be on high visibility buildings that people in the local communities will read about as the process goes through, and what we're trying to do is create a transformation of the market in the private sector, and we want to use the state as an example. And the best way for the state to be an example is when people see it, when it's visible, and people know about it. There are some buildings in the 89-91 biennium budget that are prime candidates that way. The state office building in Portland would have to be our number one priority there, because of its visibility, to try to achieve that.
You're talking about the new state office building?
Yes.
Since I presume that that's going to be in my district, I would like to have it meet the best standards that are available.
Representative Parkinson, Mr. Chair, Representative Parkinson, our major concern is to give you, the decision makers of the state, the option of which of those buildings, if any. We're in a building boom. Right. Over the next couple of bienniums, this legislature will probably allocate several hundreds of millions of dollars for new buildings. The option should be there if this is going to be state policy.